Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, and welcome to Alaska Edition on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ellen Lockyer. During the past week, we've had some important visitors to the state. Federal Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz and Senator Lisa Murkowski led an entourage of Washington, D.C. officials to Bethel and to Oscarville to see firsthand the energy challenges faced by Alaska's rural residents. Senator Murkowski also addressed the state legislature this week. And we have had some unexpected news, too. State Natural Resources Commissioner Mark Myers announced his retirement on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, Governor Walker announced some important changes regarding the Alaska LNG line. On today's Alaska Edition, we'll be discussing energy in Alaska, where Bush residents have not seen prices drop for gasoline or diesel fuel, even though gas is a little more than $2 a gallon in Anchorage. And we'll be taking a quick video tour of ConocoPhillips' Alpine oil installation near the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. But first, let's introduce our guests. Annie Zack is a business reporter with Alaska Dispatch News in Anchorage. Hello, Annie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Andrew Kitchenman, who covers the state legislature for Alaska Public Media in Juneau, is joining us via Skype. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Andrew. Thanks for being here. I know you're busy down there in Juneau. So let's start with you, Andrew. This week, some unexpected events happened in Juneau. On Tuesday, DNR Commissioner Mark Myers announced his retirement effective March 1st. So did this take the Walker administration by surprise?
It didn't take the governor by surprise. Commissioner Myers had told the governor back in October that he planned to retire. At that point, the governor basically asked him to hold on and delay the decision, but the governor knew that decision was coming.
Okay, so who's going to step in the interim?
Deputy Commissioner Marty Rutherford is going to be stepping in, and that's basically seen as a pretty smooth transition since she's been working on a lot of the same and a lot of the major issues that the commissioner was working on.
Okay. Have you heard any scuttlebutt around the Capitol as to who might be appointed to fill Myers's post?
No. The governor hasn't said who will be the permanent replacement, and it doesn't look like it's certain at this point, or at least not public in any sort of way.
Okay. And then on Wednesday, Governor Walker did take a lot of people by surprise by making an announcement quite early regarding changes in the Alaska LNG line plan. What were those changes?
Well, he didn't say what the changes would be. He wanted to make this announcement. He basically said that there are rumors going around and he wanted to provide a little more of a sense of certainty that the changes were occurring. What's sort of surprising is that how the lack of details that the governor provided. Basically, he said that there's going to be more information available next month. But one of the takeaways is it seems that the possibility of having a constitutional amendment question for the voters this November, the chances of that happening really have gone down with this announcement. The governor hasn't ruled it out, but it seemed questionable before now, and now it seems highly unlikely that things are going to be settled enough for there to be an amendment. Now, the amendment would basically provide certainty to the energy companies that are the state's partners in the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Pipeline project, that as basically about what level of taxes and what kind of costs they would be facing from the state. And they basically said they need to have that certainty to move forward. And the governor had previously basically said that there would be a special session that would develop this question that would go to voters. And now that really seems like that's not going to happen, that things are too uncertain. And really what they're trying to do is get to a point where if things remain uncertain in the future, that that there'll be a plan, and a plan that'll be more spelled out than is currently the case for what will happen next.
Right.
Well, the governor, the pipeline's still a top priority for the governor.
Right. It's the keystone of his administration. Now, the three executives from the three states partners in the proposed LNG line were present as well, and they committed to something called pre-FEED. What is that?
Yeah, so pre-FEED is basically the work that's done before FEED, which is basically the engineering and design work. And so that's what's currently needs to be done and needs to be completed. And they basically said that will be completed by this fall. And so that did provide a bit more certainty that they're going to do that. But Joe Marishak, the president for ConocoPhillips Alaska, he basically said that beyond pre-FEED, it's still very much uncertain whether Conoco is going to stay involved.
Wow.
or what their involvement will be.
So this setback in timing, let's call it that right now, is related, I would assume, to the drop in oil prices and natural gas prices?
Yeah, natural gas prices have been tracking the oil prices. And the way things stand now, the state's really looking at selling to the Asian market, and prices right now are barely half of really what they need to be on a sustained basis for this really to be economic and for there to be a market that would justify the costs of developing the pipeline.
Wow. So what are you hearing around the Capitol now? It would seem to me this setback has maybe cast a little more doubt on the reality of the LNG line ever actually happening. Are you hearing anything more pointed on that score?
I mean, I think if the prices don't improve, then that's true. But I don't think that because prices are what they are now, that has in any way lessened Governor Walker's commitment to it. And so one possibility would be that the state's role could increase, whether we're talking about the state's involvement in getting to the engineering and design phase or the state's involvement, actually the ownership of the project.
Right.
Nothing really precise at this point in time, but that it must be on some level what's being discussed behind the scenes.
Right. Well, with a price tag of $45 to $65 billion, it's not looking very good considering the state's fiscal dilemma right now. So thanks, Andrew. Stand by. I'm going to talk to Annie a bit here. Annie, we have this LNG line way over the horizon, maybe, but we do have projects that are up and running. And Annie, you toured ConocoPhillips' Alpine installation
was it this week?
It was last week.
Last week.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, what did you bring back from that? What kind of information did you find out?
Yeah, so it was the main thing that was, you know, a focus of the trip was CD5, which is the first commercial oil development within the boundaries of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. And it's within those boundaries, but it sits on land, Alaska Native-owned land. So that was sort of what the focus of this trip was. So.
And can you sort of thumbnail it for me? I was a little confused. I know that the Alpine is not an NPRA, but the ConocoPhillips' latest installation is within NPRA. That's the CD5.
Yeah, CD5. It stands for Colville Delta 5, and it's part. They consider it an extension of their Alpine operations there, which sit just on the eastern side, outside of the NPRA boundaries.
Right, and that is the first within NPRA.
First commercial, yeah.
And then there's a couple of others, I believe.
Yeah, there also is the Greater Moose's Tooth 1, which is supposed to come online in 2018, and that is a little bit further west than CD5. And then they're also hoping to explore in Greater Moose's Tooth 2, which is a little further west than that.
Right. So when you were on Alpine itself, now that's been established for quite a while. What did you see there? How did they conduct the tour, first of all?
Yeah, so we flew from Anchorage to Kuparuk and then drove in a bus from Kuparuk to Alpine, and it involves driving on an ice road there, which was particularly interesting because they build it every year and it melts every summer. And it's really just vast, frozen land, and it was really pretty incredible. There's not much that you can see in any direction except for their various drill sites. They have a couple of other sites just outside on the eastern part of the boundary of MPRA, and as well as the pipeline that runs along the side of the road that eventually feeds into the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
So Alpine is connected with the MPRA installations, right? There's a road?
Yeah, there's okay. There's a road that was built, a gravel road, connecting right. Alpine to CD5, the new site within the MPRA. Mm-hmm. That was a pretty crucial piece of infrastructure for them in getting this project going.
Well, this new CD5 well only went online last year. It was a big win, I think, for ConocoPhillips, and certainly is welcome to know that more oil is going into the taps line for the state. So, what was your biggest impression when you had you ever been to an oil facility like that before?
No. It was really interesting. I think that the infrastructure was really one of the most fascinating things about it. Everything from this ice road that costs $20 million every year to build, only to go away, and then Alpine is only accessible by air in the summer. So the infrastructure, and also it'll be interesting to see in the long term how much these fields can produce. When CD5 came online, it came online in October, and the company has already met its production estimate of 16,000 barrels of oil per day there, and that's with only finishing 8 of 15 wells planned at that time. Wow. So they're planning to, you know, that's pretty significant, and they're doing better than anticipated there, and as a result, they're looking to expand that drill site. And but they also say it's too soon to predict, you know, how much more oil that it can produce.
Too soon to predict the NPRA is installation.
Yeah.
How about Alpine? Do you have a number at the top of your head about how much that is producing?
No, and I when I asked about specifically about CD5, I would imagine it's probably, I'm not sure about Alpine specifically, but when I asked about CD5, they say, you know, there's a lot of variables like reservoir performance and drilling technology and other things that basically just make it hard to predict.
Okay, well, thanks, Annie. Yeah. Well, Alaska Public Media also sent our video crew up to Alpine along with Annie and our own Rachel Walholtz, our energy reporter, and they brought back a little visual tour. So let's take a look at what they saw.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, welcome aboard Shared Services Flight 151 with service to Kuparik.
Kuparik, Alaska is home to the second largest oil field in the United States, which is operated by ConocoPhillips.
We have a capacity of about 2,500 in total folks that we can house. We're like a little city in that we have our own power system, our own wastewater treatment system, our own potable water treatment system for basically a small-sized city.
They invited reporters to tour recent developments on the North Slope.
It's just white outside. It's like you can't see anything past the road.
Oh, it's cold.
We're fortunate now we've got some ambient light. We've got about 70 days during the year when we don't see the sun at all.
So we're heading now down to the ice road, and then we'll cross over into Alpine territory. So that's where we're heading at the moment.
An ice road connects the Alpine field with the Kuparik field.
We don't have a road access into Alpine for all the summer months of the year. And so from about late January, they construct ice roads out to Alpine. And that allows us then to resupply any of our equipment that we can't fly, that's too big to fly or just too bulky.
The ice road is operational from January through April and must be reconstructed every winter.
Some of the pads we go to, there's a lot of activity out there, a lot of drilling activity going on. We've constructed everything out there, but now we're still drilling all the wells out there. So you'll see that when we go out there.
The newest site in the MPRA is connected to Alpine Central Facility by a permanent road.
We'll go for a little bit of a tour on one of the drill rigs out there, and we'll get one of our operators to show you a little bit around.
That's the actual well right now that we're drilling.
That's the well right there.
Yeah.
The drill rig sits on a 12-acre pad above ground. Below ground, wells can spread over 50 square miles.
This is what we call a spider map, and it shows you what it looks like underground and where all the existing wells are. Currently, we're on drill site CD5, which is over here, and so you can see the extent of the wells that we have accessing the reservoirs.
So from one pad, those wells stretch out in like every direction?
Correct.
In 2015, ConocoPhillips approved plans for continued development within the boundaries of the NPRA.
Well, thank you to our producer, Casey Ellingson, and for our videographer, Eric Ketto, for the work on that video. So speaking of oil wells, this week the Bureau of Land Management announced a very ambitious program to clean up some of the remaining contaminated oil wells within the NPRA that were drilled by the U.S. government and the U.S. Geological Survey way back in the 1940s and the 50s, and some of these wells were drilled to determine the possibility of commercial drilling within NPRA. And there was 136 of these wells just abandoned and left. And I know Senator Lisa Murkowski has long been championing a program to clean them up. And she has gotten $50 million into something called the Helium Stewardship Act of 2013. And BLM has announced that they've used some of that money to clean three of the wells at Umiat within NPRA and now are going to tackle 18 of the wells this year. And they have to start doing it now while the ground is still frozen. So that is another little forward motion on, you know, an oil energy issue. These wells often were drilled in natural seeps. So as they were telling me, sometimes you see these photos of this little pipe thing sticking up in this big puddle of goo, but that was a natural pond and one of oil, and one of the reasons that what they were drilling there back in the 40s and 50s was to see, you know, what kind of oil and how deep and all of those other questions. So Senator Murkowski has been credited with getting that money to clean up those wells, some of which are leaking hazardous gases that could be harmful to human health. Andrew, I'd like to bring you back in. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, good. I've been hearing a little bit about maybe legislative discussions of some revisions to our oil tax regime. Are you hearing anything about that down there?
Well, the governor has proposed an overhaul that would reduce some tax credits and raise the floor for oil production, oil and gas production. There have been concerns from the legislature that they're not getting enough information from the administration on the economic impact of the state of putting these taxes in place. I spoke with Revenue Commissioner Randall Hoffbeck this morning, and he said that basically they made sure in designing these tax changes that they spoke with the energy companies and had a strong sense as to how these would affect the energy companies. They now are looking to do the type of analysis that the legislators are asking for, so that might be available as soon as this coming week. So we'll see if that satisfies the legislators. I think these tax changes are among the revenue increases that are more likely to happen this legislative session.
Okay, so right now it's under discussion. And with the oil price being as low as it is there any, I mean, how would those taxes be changed to encourage investment in Alaska?
Yeah, they don't want to. They certainly don't want to discourage it. So they basically shape the changes in the credits around. They basically are scaling back credits that they don't see as being effective, that either haven't been used or, you know, to the extent to which they're being used, it's for development that would be happening regardless of the credits. The change in prices is driving a lot of this because obviously the state would be bringing in so much more revenue in taxes, and if prices were higher, so they're just trying to close this $3.5 billion budget shortfall.
Okay, well, let us know how that's going to work out. I'm sure it's going to be quite the debate. They're harking back to the debate under the Parnell administration. Anyway, I would like to get back a little bit to Senator Lisa Murkowski and her trip to Bethel this week. She brought along quite an entourage from Washington, D.C., along with Ernest Moniz, our Secretary of Energy. And the point of the trip was to hold a public hearing in Bethel on rural energy issues. And then there was a side trip to Oscarville so that the Washington, D.C. folk could see firsthand what rural residents in tiny villages are up against. And apparently in Oscarville, the only flush toilet and the only running water is in the village school. So I'm sure that was an eye-opener for many on the tour. And Annie, did you go on that tour too? No, you didn't. Okay. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that Senator Murkowski pointed out, and she is the head of the Senate Energy Committee, and she is backing a rather large energy bill in Congress, in which she highlights something called, it's the miniature...
Microgrids,
our miniature grid. And can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'm not too familiar with the topic, but, you know, basically other states and agencies and the federal government are, and the private sector are also looking to Alaska as a really good example of how to use these microgrids, which are, you know, basically localized power grids that don't depend on or sometimes are not tied to the larger grid, and to power rural areas that have logistical challenges like, you know, lack of road access and things that a lot of places in Alaska are very, you know, accustomed to.
Right, and they would use partially diesel, which they're using pretty much all now, and then in concert with either hydropower, if it's available, or wind power, solar power. And this has been done successfully in Alaska in many tiny rural villages, and is catching the attention on a national basis. In fact, some of the innovations in Alaska are being looked at on maybe a global scale for areas like arid areas in Europe or Asia, and it's starting to attract a lot of attention. Have you done any reporting on this?
No, I haven't personally. We have, our paper has, and I just remember an official from the New Jersey, I believe, Board of Utilities mentioning that Alaska is really blazing a trail in that area as something to look to, you know, something that other states look to.
So. Right, and over the course of my own reporting, there's been small pockets. They've been a hydro project here. Seward has a tidal energy project and, you know, solar projects, wind projects going, but we're starting to step back and say, wow, we've really accomplished quite a bit of knowledge here and technical expertise in these areas.
Yeah, and I think there's more than 200 of these microgrids in Alaska, of these microgrid projects. So,
and hopefully our Washington, D.C. group will take some of their newfound knowledge back to the Washington, D.C. And put it to good use, we hope. So Senator Murkowski has really done a lot. She also has spoken to the Alaska legislature, I believe it was Wednesday morning. And Andrew, did you listen to that speech?
Yes. She got a very warm reception from the legislature. I think there's a sense of being reassured that as she's gained experience and seniority in the Senate, that Alaska is regaining to some extent the influence or at least the seniority that it once had under Senator Stevens and her father. And people liked the message she had. She touched on many of the state's key industries and basically said that she's a voice for federal support for the state in those industries.
Right, and she also had some good news for the construction industry and the military. She said there would be about military construction money on its way to Alaska, something to the tune of $561 million coming our way. Did she mention any details on that money? Yeah.
Basically, what she had to say really resonated with the legislators. I don't have the details.
Okay. She also mentioned highway. Money. There's a federal highway bill that is going to bring something like $585 million to Alaska by the year 2021. That seems far away, but time flies. So that is some encouraging news for a state that is facing some very fiscal big challenges. And she has also, we mentioned the Oscarville tour. So I was going to wrap this up a little bit with asking about what's going on in Juneau energy-wise. Andrew, are you hearing anything coming out of the legislature? I know the budget is a big yeah. obstacle, I mean, but is there anything in it for energy
With the House focused on the budget, anything that's happening in that side of the legislature is going to be budget related. So the bills that we were talking about earlier, the bill related to taxes is the big one. And that's going to be asking for more money from in one form or another from the energy industry, but certainly the administration and the legislature don't want to do that in a way that's going to discourage investment.
Okay. Thanks for being with us, Andrew. Annie, and you're on the business beat. What are you hearing?
Well, specifically something that you mentioned about construction, I think that is good news, especially because construction spending is predicted to drop about 18% this year in the state. So any news about more spending in that area is
okay,
good.
Annie, Zach, thank you. We're running out of time. Yeah. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Thanks for tuning in to Alaska Edition. We'll be back next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.